Warning, the explicit language in this podcast is starting to rub off on the Pope.
Today's episode of The Scathing Atheist is brought to you by the Hindu sex worker industry of South Asia. For live shows, come on down to the Hindude Ranch. And if you want to get laid in your second life, visit our brother and sister websites, Fudge Pakistan and PoonjabPoonjobs.com. And now, The Scathing Atheist.
I think we got off the track when we allowed our government to become a secular government. When we stop realizing that God created this nation.
Hi, this is David. Recently, no one named me the Scathing Atheist's most generous donor ever. So if you think you've got what it takes to try and take this title away from me, bring it on. And if you do, you too might get the chance to open the show by saying that we did indeed evolve from filthy monkey men.
It's March 6th.
And Christian Mingle for Godless Horny Geriatrics should be called RadioCarbonDating.com.
I'm No Illusions.
I'm Heath Enright, and from Black History Forgotten, New York, New York.
And Black History Still Embraced, Podunk, Georgia, this is The Scathing Atheist.
In this week's episode, the pedophile isn't Catholic. Just kidding, he's obviously Catholic.
We'll hit you up for money at the end of the show.
And conception just got pushed back again. Used to occur at orgasm, then it was the third pump, if applicable. And now it officially happens retroactively at puberty.
But first, the diatribe. I picture three guys sitting around in hell. One says, I shot my wife. And the other guy says, I burned down an orphanage. And the other guy says, I baked a cake for some queers. You know, luckily, Arizona Governor Jan Brewer forestalled the national embarrassment of SB 1062 with a last-minute pang of cognizance, but we were still one crayon-scrawled signature away from a state redacting humanhood for 3.5% of their population, or 2.25%. I don't know if bisexual cakes are as sinful as gay cakes. The legislation doesn't make that clear. All right, so we're talking about a bill here that passed through both state houses and probably would have been signed into law if not for the tsunami of national media attention that would have allowed anyone the right to discriminate against anyone provided their bigotry was based on, quote, a sincerely held religious belief. Here's a bullshit phrase we've heard a lot on this show. There's a huge national effort to build a big wall of Bibles to hide behind when we secularists come to take away their God-given right to hate men who love men, and women who love women, and just women. And I'm going to give religious people a little more credit than most here, because I don't think religion is the source of the bigotry at all. I think these people are just good old-fashioned bigots, and Jesus makes for a willing scapegoat. And therein lies the problem. As Anne Lamott points out, God hates all the same people you hate. So hate can always hide behind religion. In fact, as soon as you invoke the words religious liberty, you can hide any damn thing you want back there. To you and me, religious liberty means the freedom to practice one's religion, but to these theocrats, apparently it means freedom to do whatever the hell I want, regardless of the law, so long as Jesus. And of course, Jesus can't chime in here. We can't test their religious doctrines against reality. We can't measure their faith. It makes it a legal panacea. You don't want to serve gays? Religious liberty. You don't want to rent to an unwed couple? Religious liberty. Don't think that people should have recreational orgasms? Religious liberty. Not only does this provide the legal justification of this kind of shit, but it also provides the psychological justification. If you take away all the God nonsense, you force somebody to explain their objection to gays or gay marriage or gays eating at restaurants, pretty quickly they have to come face to face with the ugliest part of themselves. But as long as they can retreat to Leviticus, they don't have to bother with real morality at all. And people act like this is some kind of intractable problem. How can we ever balance religious freedom in the interests of the secular state? How can we assure that no one's rights are trampled upon and everyone's rights are protected? They act like this is a question that's hard to answer. But if everybody just follows the same rules, the problem disappears. Just get rid of any law that is contingent on a religious belief. And we're in the clear. In other words, if it's illegal to suck a baby's cock, it's just illegal to suck a baby's cock. Is anybody out there arguing that, like, the use of psychedelics is less dangerous if you think they're carrying you into the spirit realm? Is anybody honestly arguing that bigotry is less dangerous if you think it's divinely sanctioned? And of course, nobody wants to carry this the whole way. You know, even these rampaging bigots in the Arizona legislature draw the line at the United Methodist Church of Methamphetamines. So what they're asking for, nay, what they're demanding, is that the government get in the business of deciding what does and doesn't count as a religious belief. That's the exact opposite of religious liberty.
They're talking about your Jesus.
We interrupt this broadcast and bring you a special news bulletin.
Joining me for headlines tonight is the oft-misunderstood Heath Enright. Heath, are you ready to help everybody better understand the scathing atheist satire system?
Yes, I am. So here's how it works. When I say things that sound sexist or racist, that part is satire. My true opinion on the issue is that women and non-white people as groups are generally much better than men and white people as groups.
Appreciate you saving some time with the complaints department.
Do what I can. In our lead story tonight, Seventh-day Adventist parents Nicosiafa and Virginia Kunene admitted to something known as secular manslaughter after causing the death of their five-month-old son by giving him rickets and then refusing him rickets medicine.
Fucking rickets?
Yep, rickets.
That's a fucking old-timey disease. That's like dying of the summer complaint or milk leg.
The milk leg. So, two important points here. Yes, it's really easy to prevent rickets. Don't be an infant who is a vegan with no vitamin D in your diet. And yes, it's easy to treat rickets. Vitamin D. It's also now very easy to prevent polio and amoebic dysentery and plague. Diseases that killed you on the Oregon Trail shouldn't be a threat anymore. If your kid dies of cholera, why were you bathing him in a dirty puddle? What are you doing? I mean, you should have just caulked the wagon or something. It's your fault either way.
All you got to do is not sequester them from medicine and try to stupid the malnutrition away instead. It's that easy.
Indeed it is. Now, here's a statement from Justice Singh, who apparently had to explain his reasoning when he ruled that when you murder your child because you're stupid, it has to be at least a little bit illegal. Quote, "The right to manifest one's religion is not absolute. It's limited in particular by the rights of others. Fucking duh. The state has a particularly important duty to protect the right to life, especially when a young child is concerned." End quote. So it did have the fucking duh in there. Now, besides turning pro-life rhetoric against religion, tastes bitter, doesn't it? The justice makes an extremely important distinction here that is really the crux of just about every argument on this subject. You can think and believe whatever you want, but you can't manifest those beliefs in ways that threaten the lives of others, especially five-month-old children that are yours.
Right.
Idiots.
I'm sorry, but anybody who ever pretended that God exists or that prayer did stuff has at least a little bit of this kid's blood on their hands.
That's right. A little bit of smallpox-infested infant blood on your hands. Can't feel as good as you thought it would, does it? Because if you build it up in your head as this great thing, and then, you know, it's an inevitable letdown. The
right, like Superman.
Infant blood on the hands, yeah.
And in the I'd never have molested him if you had aborted him news tonight, the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis is blaming a mother for allowing her children to be molested by one of their priests.
Well, he was a priest, so
right, yeah.
Buyer beware.
Reverend Curtis Waymire, who I'll grant couldn't look more like a kitty diddler without a Pee Wee Herman suit, molested two of her sons, aged 12 and 14, and upon discovering that the Archdiocese knew he was a sexual predator before they hired him...
Again, priest.
She sued. And apparently they were going with this, like, what kind of responsible parent would have left their kids with a Catholic priest defense? So I guess that's kind of reasonable.
Right. And that's the corollary to the what kind of God would allow 12 and 14-year-old kids to be raped without
right.
letting their mother win a large settlement, which correctly puts a dollar value on the consent virginity and regular virginity of a child defense. And in praising the stakes news, the Kentucky Baptist Convention is promoting what they call Second Amendment celebrations, encouraging churches to give away dead cow slices and deadly firearms to local heathens if they're willing to open a trial account with God. Despite nearly everyone in these fly areas already owning livestock and murder weapons, this soul bribery thing seems to be working anyway.
You know, this kind of reminds me of the story that we covered a couple of weeks ago about the racist Black History Month lunch menu. Because, I mean, like, steaks and guns is probably the white trash-ist equivalent of offering black people watermelon and cornbread, except in this case, the race being stereotyped is too stupid to realize it.
Yeah, they're proud. Now, their plan, reportedly labeled Outreach to Rednecks by a spokesman, swear to God.
You made that up.
Did not make that up.
Oh, no,
but
shit.
Doesn't it sound a lot like animated wabbit hunting or something? I mean, like luring godless tea partiers under a box, like floating them by their nose with the cartoon smell of animal blood and gun oil, and then just knocking the stick out and holds the box up.
Ooh, piece of candy.
Exactly.
And in bowing towards Megatron news tonight, an Iranian school teacher has developed the perfect Muslim. It's an unthinking automaton that does nothing useful and prays five times a day. Akbar Rezai, who teaches mythology and doesn't realize it at an elementary school in the Iranian town of Veraman, has recently unveiled a small humanoid robot that he created to help teach children how to properly appease Muslim God.
Well, if you follow the Quran and get to the Allah spark, I understand it, you get 72 unused Sibian machines. So that's pretty sweet. Brand spanking new Sibian machines with the extra orifice attachment. They're for, you know, guys, robots are female and male. Yeah.
Rezai hopes his robot will make prostrating oneself before an invisible warlock cool again. Some people have criticized him for using cutting-edge science to promote the opposite of science, but those allegations clearly overlook what a low-tech piece of shit his little robot really is.
So, what's the robot's name? Halal 9000?
Oh, nice. That's way better than the bowing to Megatron shit.
Also, I'd like to quickly note that the evil computer antagonist from 2001 A Space Odyssey has the same name as Halliburton's ticker symbol. Just saying. Just saying.
I'll alert Alex Jones immediately.
And in Catholic Gestapo news, an anti-prostitution operation in Phoenix, Arizona, called Project Rose, is detaining suspected sex workers at a local church and forcing them to choose between religious propaganda class and jail. And that's a tough call, considering it's pretty risky to drop the soap at either venue. I'm not clear on whether where I'd rather go.
Right, right. You don't want Jesus inside of you, but you don't want Jesus inside of you either. So.
Is that a racist joke or an anti-Christian joke? It's both. It's both. I love it. It's perfect.
Damned if you do, damned if you do.
Indeed. The orgasm specialists who wish to avoid prison must complete a 36-hour Jesus sexuality class, which teaches great ideas like prostitutes not using condoms.
Or getting abortions.
Right. And in order to pass the program, which has a reported 30% graduation rate, the accused must also display sufficient amounts of sadness and shame. All sounds awful and stupid, but there is some good news. The First Amendment says the police have to wrangle whore interns for atheist clubs, too, now. So,
oh, fucking A. Awesome.
Now, as long as we got a bunch of sex workers forced into cages at a church, I'd say the stage is set. And also, in honor of the Oscars last weekend, this is apropos, let's put 30 seconds on the clock. Religious porn parodies of Best Picture nominees. Go.
Oh, nice, nice. All right, but first I want to thank God for giving me an award that I don't need or deserve, rather than curing the disease the movie that I'm winning this award was about in the first place. And, of course, the movie I'm referring to here is The Phallus Buyers Club. See? There,
well done, sir. Well done, sir. Good movie to watch with a cocktail, from what I understand. All right, what about 12 Years Old, A Slave?
Oh, nice. Topical. Little Mr. Sunshine?
Nice. Kneeling in the Confessional Booth. Tales from the Squirt Locker. We're calling it the Squirt Locker now.
Nice. Fetal Attraction?
Excellent. Semen on the Brokeback Mount.
Oh, nice, nice. I see what you did there. Father Cassidy and the Unpantsed Kid.
Right. The father's the butch and the kid's the bitch. I get it. I get it. What about 50 Shekels of Silver Linings Playbook?
That one starred Jennifer Lawrence of the Labia, didn't it?
Indeed. A good climax, but I think it was missing something. Might have been Consent of a Woman. I'm not sure. We had to go. We waited a while before we went to the rape joke there. I just like everybody to realize how right. Fucking nice we were about that. Moving on.
Oh, I got one. The Pleasure of the Sierra Padre.
Fantastic. Fantastic.
Thank you.
The Fugitive Priest, Around the World in 80 Gays.
Nice.
Yeah, got a couple in there.
How about $1 million Baby Fucking Settlement?
About
Finding Neverland Ranch. The kids are all tight. At least at first. Okay, one more try at the double bonus. Vishnu's Avatar, go fuck yourself. I'm sorry, I'll show myself out.
That's all right. The band was already playing us off anyway. So I guess that's going to do it for headlines this week. Heath, thanks as always.
Masayanara, bitches.
And when we come back, Lucinda will be here to give you a double dose of biblical boredom. Awesome email that I got this week. I absolutely had to share it. It was really actually hard to wait until the show came out to share it. If this is legit, and I honestly think it is, it was from Ray Comfort. Apparently, he's like semi-aware of our show, knows about some aspects and not others, and he sent me this really complimentary message about how important it is for atheists to read the Bible and how he's sure that Jesus will reveal himself to me along the way. In fact, I guess he was so impressed by our commitment to get a broader perspective on the Bible, he wanted to, you know, to do whatever the theistic equivalent would be, you know, try something out that he dislikes and disagrees with in order to widen his perspective on it. So I guess him and Ken Ham got together and tried out gay sex for the first time. And as luck would have it, they were nice enough to send me along an audio clip of that erotic encounter.
Hi, I'm Ken Ham.
Well, my name is Ray Comfort.
Well, good evening.
When I arrived, you had a hotel room for me and even a fruit basket.
Oh, he's tall and muscly.
Say that again.
Oh, he's handsome and tall, and he's the star, and oh, I'd like to go out with him.
Thank you.
Why do we wear clothes?
Well, we all do that.
See, unless they're taken off...
Okay, can I just stop you there?
Don't be intimidated.
There's nothing I have to look at and say I'm embarrassed.
When it's okay, rip it out.
Behold!
It's a pretty big number, isn't it?
Commonly known as the banana man.
It's enormous.
Notice how gracefully it sits over the human hand.
A perfect creation.
Notice it has a point at the top for ease of entry. It's just the right shape for the human mouth.
We weren't told we could eat meat.
And it's even curved toward the face to make the whole process so much easier.
Yet another poke in the eye.
The contents don't squirt in your face.
But you don't know that, and there's a lot of evidence that that's not so.
Okay, it's my turn.
Check it out.
There's nothing I have to look at.
You don't see that?
No, I don't.
I'm sort of a little...
You addict this magic wand of nothing.
It's not the outside that matters at all, it's the inside.
So this is a very important issue.
Now I want you to look at my point.
Well, I said it was pathetic when I started.
And what I want to show you is how this works.
Could you explain it to me?
That's where it comes from, just so you know.
That's common sense.
Even if you've got a dead stick.
But you're sprung.
There is a book out there with this diagram here. They're sitting one on top of the other.
Why?
To make a game.
Tell me why.
You'll learn the lesson the hard way.
If you could put your finger on one...
No.
Okay, here's a fork. Stick it in there.
But there's limits.
Anything that fits.
No. We're going to look at dogs in particular to help us understand this.
I've got to get to the bottom of this.
You know, there was plenty of room.
Okay, here it is.
Okay, all right.
Oh, no.
Oh, God.
Oh, God, God.
It's a little difficult.
It's easier if you try.
Oh, God.
Oh,
wow.
Oh, God, God.
This is so radical, it'll blow your mind.
Of course it is.
Oh, God.
Oh.
Sir, I can't go on, my brain is full.
You have to let me finish.
Oh.
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 Oh. Oh.
Would you come? You're just an animal.
I came.
Man, that was radical.
Put another notch in my belt.
Why haven't we already done this?
The Holy Babel.
Originally, the books of Ezra and Nehemiah were a single book and remain intact in the Hebrew Bible, which is odd because the Hebrews aren't really known for leaving things intact. Anyway, since they're both short and they more or less tell a linear story, we elected to double up this week and give you twice as much babble.
Yeah, anything that gets us through it quicker, basically.
Yeah.
Also, in honor of Noah turning 30 mumble today, we decided to party hard, rage with our Hebrew Lit Book Club. So, happy birthday, Noah.
Thank you, sir.
Also, I'd like to say you would have loved to be out in New York City today on your birthday. For some reason, all the Catholics were wearing some kind of cum target on their face. Now, my aim was off today, so I'm not sure exactly how many points you get if you actually hit the black X, but I imagine it's like a million, so we would have had a blast.
And joining us, of course, in this masochistic biblical endeavor is my lovely wife, Lucinda. Lucinda, welcome back.
We always meet under the worst circumstances, the three of us, you know it.
All right, so when we last left off our intrepid heroes, they were scraping their way out of exile in Babylon.
Thanks to the good King Cyrus. He sends word to all the Jews that they can go back to Jerusalem and rebuild the temple, and he even gives back all of the vessels of the house of the Lord that Nebuchadnezzar stole.
And apparently, as they were re-inhabiting the Promised Land, everybody went through an amusement park turnstile or something, and somebody checked IDs, because in Chapter 2 we get a precise head count tribe by tribe.
You approach the turnstiles leading into the ancient Jerusalem circus, and you know that when you get there, you have to give the man 2 shekels, or he won't let you in. But when you get there, everything goes wrong. Dogs fuck the Pope, no fault of mine.
But first things first, they celebrate Sukkot and then get to work rebuilding their temple.
Sukkot, and Sukkot.
They suck it.
Yeah. Sukkot tents double as a circus venue, so that was perfect.
But the man always be holding them down. You know, they try to rebuild their temple here, but the kids from the cool fraternity show up and start making trouble for them, so they have to stop.
Try Lambda, Lambda, Lambda of God. So you guys remember that Jewish tribe that we enslaved, that we definitely can't trust because we enslaved them after centuries of genocidal warfare? Well, Cyrus let them start building a giant god castle again. Could be real god. Our prayers don't do shit. That's all I'm saying. Is this something you guys think we need to worry about? That's all I'm saying. We look into it.
Perhaps we should. And you can tell that the Bronze Age FCC was getting on their ass about all the wars and genocides in Season 1, because when shit hits the fan in Ezra, we get a vigorous letter-writing campaign.
Right.
I was hoping they would address the paperwork situation, finally, because, you know, building a temple to an exotic god without a permit within the
Jerusalem city limits, that ain't legal either.
You got it. I thought this was Trans-Euphrates. Are we not in Trans-Euphrates? I thought it was living in Trans-Euphrates.
Now, eventually, the Jews find all the necessary receipts and whatnot and get permission to finish their temple, which they do.
And that's great. Unless, of course, you're a local bull, ram, lamb, or goat, in which case you'll be brutally slaughtered to appease Jew God's bloodlust.
And now that we're 2/3 of the way through this book, plus, we meet the titular Ezra, who knows his Mosaic law like nobody's business, and on the merits of this, King Artaxerxes, I think, gives him all of Jerusalem.
And then all of a sudden we're in the first person, which is really fucking weird.
Yeah, taking over as objective narrator in God's book. The balls on this guy. Unbelievable.
So Ezra gathers a sufficient number of Jews, divvies up the cash, fasts for a while, and then heads back to the newly rebuilt temple.
Then he makes it very clear to everyone that the reason God exiled them was obvious. They weren't being racist enough. So he makes sure everyone knows to be extra racist this time around.
Yeah, he even says that you can't see to the peace and prosperity of the neighboring tribes, so you're not even allowed to just be passively racist.
Middle East is like the crazy kid in school getting tricked into fighting the even crazier other kid in school. It's like a fun TV show for atheists. Deluded giant squid versus equally naive but tribally different mega shark. Just eat each other. Go.
So to keep Jew God from getting pissy again, Ezra orders anyone who married a foreigner to send away their wives and children.
There's even a detailed miscegenation list with all the people who cheated and gave their kids illegal performance enhancers like dominant DNA. They wrote it all down.
Right. So
asterisks and everything.
Clearly, Ezra just blew the right scribe to get his own book in the Bible. And the same is almost certainly true of Nehemiah, whose claim to fame was building a wall where once there was only most of a wall.
Right, fascinating stuff. So first we meet Nehemiah, who spends chapter 1 shitting all over Ezra. They rebuilt the temple, so he decides to lament the fact that they didn't also do the wall. I'm better than Ezra, chapter 1. Done.
So Nehemiah is all bummed. Meanwhile, he's landed this awesome gig bearing the king's cup, if you know what I mean.
Wink, wink. So King Artaxerxes asks what he's so bummed about. He tells him, and the king's like, oh, yeah, here's some lumber and stone. Go rebuild your wall, whatever.
Then he inspects the wall, including the unfortunately named Dung Gate.
Right.
Shit joke. Yeah.
Talk about using the rear entrance.
Anal joke. One-upped it. And you get some blatant evidence planting right here. So they're working on the rebuild, and three rival officials, a Horonite, an Ammonite, and an Arab, Might as well walk into a Jewish bar as a premise to a joke and ask Nehemiah if his crew is going to rebel against the king. So Nehemiah, as if wearing a wire, says, "Hello, three people that represent the historical property rights of your entire future race, who agree that you have no claim, share, or historic right to Jerusalem whatsoever. Say nothing if you agree forever done. Why do you guys care? Why do you care? Moving on to that new question."
And everybody goes out, hands across Jerusalem style, and they all fix a little section of the wall.
And then Sanballat, who is apparently the mean girl from a cheerleading movie of biblical villains, starts writing letters to Nehemiah telling him, like, "You know, I'm going to spread rumors about you and blow your boyfriend if you don't stop building this wall."
And in case you missed the exhaustive list of which tribes of all the returning exiles were from, we get it again in chapter 7. Because this book fucking repeats itself constantly.
If you want to make the book longer, just increase the margins or the font size or, I don't know, add a chapter about morality or being reasonable or a how-to guide on reading allegories. Plenty of good options to add to this book besides in giant lists.
And then they all get together to love God and live in booths.
And to be honest, I'm half convinced that you could just start reading the Bible at chapter 9 of Nehemiah and you don't miss much. Because in this chapter, Ezra spends this extremely long chapter going on and on about how awesome God is by rehashing almost everything that's happened in the book so far.
Right. And then he drives home the two main points of the last 6 or 7 books. 1, God needs you to kill a lot of goats for him.
Yep.
And 2, don't forget to be racist.
Yep.
Whatever you do, don't interbreed with any of those damn foreigners.
Yeah. By all means, let's keep all these recessive genes to ourselves.
Yeah, you gotta be racist in the right direction. Withhold that blind, translucent, polydactyl piano prodigy genes. Smart. Smart. Stay pale on 3. 1, 2, 3.
Stay pale!
Jurah.
Jurah. Nehemiah then makes the mistake of turning his back for a second, and within a few days, priests are setting up rooms for their old frat buddies in the temple. They're working on the Sabbath, and they're marrying the foreigners.
Right, so he beats them and pulls out their hair.
Yeah, literally. Yep. Handfuls of soulless ginger clumps. Awful.
Heck of a guy, that Nehemiah.
Yeah, so in summary, the Jews are back and they have a temple and a wall again.
That's all they really needed to say.
Goers are back in town.
Didn't need 23 chapters for that. Thanks for bearing with it, guy and gal.
You got it. Holy Babel.
Holy Babel.
Before we get played off tonight, I wanted to let everybody know about something I'm really stoked about. At the behest of a number of our listeners, I spent the last few weeks compiling the first 50 diatribes into book form. Many of them have been rewritten or lengthened, and I've added a few paragraphs of introduction to each one, so you can think of it as like the behind-the-scene director's cut of the diatribes. More than a third of the book is all new material, and that should be available as an ebook on the 20th of March. We hope to have physical copies available by ReasonCon at the beginning of May. We'll be talking that up a bunch over the next couple of weeks, of course. And if you were hoping for a poem tonight, sorry about that. It'll be on next week's show. Part of that, of course, was to make room for the scandalous Ham Comfort sex tape, but after some discussion with Heath and Lucinda, we're all of the mind that it generally makes more sense to do the Bible poems after we've reviewed the book in question rather than before. Now, that's all the blasphemy we've got for you this week, but we'll be back in 168 hours with more. Between now and then, I have to thank Heath for his continued commitment to excellence in excrement jokes. I need to thank Lucinda for all that she brings to the show, and I need to thank David for providing this week's Farnsworth quote and for his incredible generosity. Here's hoping he just sparked a bidding war to claim the title of the most generous donor ever. But most of all, of course, I need to thank this week's most valuable humans, Paul, Rebecca, Michael, Crystal, Andrew, Shane, and Joel. Paul, whose mighty fists serve as the primary backup system for the Large Hadron Collider. Rebecca, who's such a badass she has to let alligators tag team when she wrestles them. Michael, whose dick is so big it has Lagrangian points. Crystal, whose intellect is so vast it could hold 2 of every unclean animal and 7 of every clean one. Andrew, who's too sexy to play Jesus. Shane, whose biceps are powerful enough to run the flux capacitor. And Joel, who's so hot Stacy's mom sings songs about him. These bright, shining examples of altruism have earned their spot in my anti-Putin bunker this week by giving us money. Only the smartest, strongest, sexiest secularists have what it takes to give us money, but if you feel like you've got the requisite syllabus, you'll find the donate button on the right side of the homepage at scathingatheist.com. And of course, if you love the show but you spent your entire entertainment budget on Romanian vampire porn, you can also help us a ton by leaving us a glowing review on iTunes or whatever place you prefer to leave glowing podcast reviews. And if you just can't get enough of us, be sure to check us out on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and of course, check out our erratically published blog. If you have questions, comments, or death threats, you'll find all the contact info on the contact page at scathingatheist.com. All the music used in this episode was written and performed by yours truly, and yes, I did have my permission.
Fuck that up. I'm gonna say something different.